today. Straight to the phone lines we go. Very excited to have our next guest on the program. As we do every week, it's Greg Wyshynski from ESPN here on the Halford and Brough Show. What up, Wish?
How are you?
We're good, thanks. I just finished reading at the break your most recent piece for ESPN.com. Best headline so far. 10 reasons to root for the Montreal Canadiens, I guess. Now, you don't have to give all 10 reasons. I want people to read the article and visit your site, but give us an overview.
Well, I've been struggling. I've been struggling to find reasons to get excited about this team advancing. Okay. I've been struggling to find reasons why I want to continue watching the playoffs with this team involved. And so I had a journey of self-reflection, find reasons to get excited. Like, you know, little tiny Cole Caulfield skating around the ice and doing offensive things. Or, you know, tapping into my 95 Devils fandom of having enjoyed watching a team that no one wanted to watch and felt that their success could be the quote-unquote death of hockey. But I also reached out to some friends, like Jay Baruchel, our actor-director friend.
Yeah.
And he framed it this way, which I thought was interesting, which is that this Montreal team is an actual underdog. It's hard to kind of categorize any Montreal team as an underdog because they're basically like the New York Yankees of hockey, you know? Like, their next championship, like, if they won the Cup this year, they would have more championship years than the Minnesota Wild have years.
Yeah.
But Jay said that, you know, this is one of the first teams you can remember that is playing unencumbered by the weight of history, and that there's something really pure about that. And that kind of struck me, you know, that this is a team that isn't necessarily tied to all of the other Montreal teams. That's kind of its own animal, and I appreciated that viewpoint.
Wish, I want to talk a bit about the Islanders who eliminated the Bruins yesterday. I think my question is going to be, who looks worse, the Washington Capitals for moving on from Barry Trotz or the Toronto Maple Leafs for moving on from Lou Lamoriello?
It's the Capitals, and it's not close, because The thing about the Islanders is that Lou took over someone else's roster, okay, and made it better, and deserves kudos for that. I mean, he made some very smart decisions. I mean, the Varlamov thing has worked, and the pickups at the trade deadline with Palmieri and Zajac have worked out nicely, and obviously the Pageau trade worked out nicely. But the majority of this team was built by a gentleman whose name is now lost in time. Garth Snow is the reason why this Islanders team is this Islanders team. Barry Trotz is someone that you don't get rid of over some pithy financial contractual issue. And I know that there is sort of a theory on from Capitals fans that he wasn't like that great and made some bad decisions. And I'm here for that. But I'm also here for the stark reality of the situation, which is that the Washington Capitals spent a couple of years wandering the wilderness with Todd Reirden as their coach when it should have been Barry Trotz, and they might have been able to collect another Stanley Cup.
We've got a poll question this morning. Is Barry Trotz the best coach in the NHL? We've had 400 votes on it, and 72% of our listeners say yes. So I think the respect for Barry Trotz, even in a place like Vancouver where he's never coached before, is pretty high. I just think of what the Islanders were like as a team before he got there. And by that, I mean they were actually quite fun to watch, but they were horrible defensively, just a mess defensively. And then he gets there, John Tavares has left, and all of a sudden, in terms of goals against, they're one of, if not the best team in the NHL. There has to be something about the coach there.
Yeah, I mean, it's the coach, it's the system, it's the friends that he brings along, like Mitch Korn is goaltending guru to, you know, turn every goalie that's ever played for Barry Trotz into something beyond expectation. But I mean, Trotz said it himself the other day. He arrived in New York and he knew his first mission had to be to teach these guys how to play defense. And when you watch this team, I think there's two things you see. One is that they're so fundamentally sound in their own zone. They rarely at 5-on-5 make a critical error, forced or unforced, that results in a goal. But the thing about them, and I don't know if maybe I just misread them last postseason. I don't think I did. I think they really were kind of boring.
Yeah.
But they're playing a really aggressive brand of forecheck. Mm-hmm. And if you watch that game last night, the first four goals of that game were created off of defensive miscues that all could be credited to the way the Islanders forechecked the Bruins. In three cases, turnovers. In one case, Charlie McAvoy just getting outworked by, you know, a 55-year-old Travis Zajac. So, like, you know, there's something to be said about the way they're playing. And, you know, I dropped a 95 Devils reference already on the show about the Canadiens. I think in some ways the Islanders are more the proxy of it, where they have the ability to take it to you when necessary and cycle in the zone. And my God, they had a cycle for about a minute. Yeah. With less than 3 minutes left in the game last night, protecting a two-goal lead against the Bruins. It was insane.
So you're
Or they can just shut it down.
That was awesome. And I thought they were going to kill the clock. There was like 2 minutes left. I was like, and I thought the Islanders fans were going to do the soccer thing where they're going to do the ole every time that another pass was completed.
Take it to the corner flag. Just stay down there for a while.
No, you know what? You brought up a great point, because the Islanders were boring in the bubble last year. But
I thought so.
In a very weird way, their game almost got tailored to the surroundings. By that, I mean, with no fans in attendance and a game where you can play with zero emotion, they had the perfect game plan because it was just dull. They just kind of dulled their way to the conference final. And then this year, with the frenzied fans on Long Island and the great home crowd that they've got, all of a sudden this forecheck plays perfectly into that, because it's like it's based on energy and the emotion from the crowd. You can't tell me that they didn't get some juice from playing on Long Island, playing at Nassau. And it's a really interesting dynamic, because I highly doubt that Barry Trotz is tailoring specifics to the surroundings. It just
Matt
seems
Grizzlick is happy that there will be no more Nassau.
He was not good last night.
He was horrible last night. But I think you hit on it, which is that the energy that's created by Nassau Coliseum can't be underestimated in the series. I've been there for two rounds now. It was loud against Pittsburgh. It was, you know, migraine inducing against Boston, the volume in that place when they get going. And there's such a spirit amongst those fans right now. I think, you know, they should send an edible arrangement to Bruce Cassidy for giving them the New York Saints meme, which was prominent last night. And I'm sure will only carry over to subsequent rounds, where every time the Islanders get called for a penalty or on the penalty kill, they're going to start chanting New York Saints. And it's just hilarious. They were chanting it like at the end of last game as the seconds were ticking down. So the fans in that building are certainly a character in this drama. And it's something that the Lightning are going to have to be cognizant of. But I also think it's something the Lightning are attuned to handle, because this is a team that kind of just knows how to win right now.
We're speaking to Greg Wyshynski from ESPN here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. You mentioned the word drama there, Greg, and I can't think of a better one to describe the relationship between the city of Boston, the Boston Bruins, and Tuukka Rask, who very may well have played his final game for the Bruins last night in a game where he clearly wasn't 100% and didn't perform particularly well. I know that you were sort of live tweeting when Bruce Cassidy was asked about Rask, and then Rask was asked about his future. And for those that are listening right now, maybe are not 100% familiar, the Roberto Luongo relationship with Vancouver and all the highs and lows and drama, very similar to what Tuukka Rask has gone through in Boston during the duration of his career. Outstanding numbers, tons of accolades, but there's always been this weird dynamic at play. And we've seen it time and time again where, you know, you feel like the fans are really quick to turn on him. I know you've paid attention to this a lot. Where do you think this goes from now between the Bruins and Tuukka Rask?
Well, I think remind me on the Luongo thing. Was it a situation where the critics felt that he was the reason they lost, but his defenders felt that he was infallible, even giving up four goals in an elimination game? That's kind of where Rask is. It's the weirdest thing. There's no middle ground.
Yes.
Like, it's either you are for him or you are against him in Boston. And, you know, as far as his future, you know, he mentioned that surgery is a likely option for whatever ailed him in this game. He clearly wasn't 100% the last two games. They clearly didn't have the faith in Jeremy Swayman to come in and perform in an environment like that last night, and that's understandable. The real question is, as an unrestricted free agent, like, what comes next? And look, they like him. I think that's clear. They know what they have in him. He's a known commodity. But he's going to be due a good chunk of money. He's getting up in age. And maybe there are some other options to think about. And maybe there are better ways to dispensate that salary when you look at that Bruins team, mm-hmm. and specifically the blue line, and say to yourself, we need to, you know, up this ante a little bit, and we may have some internal solutions in goal.
It's Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. We're talking to ESPN's Greg Wyshynski. Wish, there's some TVs in our studio right now, and I'm looking at Mark Scheifele addressing the media. What did you think of his comments? Very upset with the Department of Player Safety, just very upset with the media, just very upset in general.
Yeah, I mean, I want to help him. I think he needs a little bit of help and guidance. He was saying that the Department of Player Safety didn't tell him what he should have done on that play. So let me take a shot at it. Use your stick is the thing that I might have done differently on that play, rather than trying to truck a guy as he's scoring an empty net goal with seconds left on the clock. I'd probably try to use my stick in some way, which actually, I don't know if you guys remember, the Department of Player Safety mentioned. They're like, hey, maybe use your stick. Yeah. Oh, you didn't? Mm-hmm. Well, then you're clearly just trying to truck a guy and race from the other end of the ice to do so, which, you know, by the letter of the law is charging. I know why he's being petulant, and I understand it. He's not a dirty player. And so you got people saying he's dirty or saying this, that, or any other thing. You want to prove yourself, you know, you want to kind of mend your reputation. I completely mm-hmm. understand that logic, and I completely understand that motivation. But take some ownership, man. Like, you handed the series to Montreal. there's no other way about it. Like, I know we can talk about, oh, they pay Kyle Connor and Blake Wheeler all this money and yada, yada, yada. We've seen this team now in two different postseasons without Mark Scheifele in the lineup. They all start shrugging their shoulders. They lose the offensive engine for the lineup. And then the whole thing kind of falls apart. And so by taking himself out of 2-3-4, he handed Montreal the series. And I know the argument is like, well, you shouldn't be that thin, or one player shouldn't make a difference. He's the number one center.
Yeah.
He's the guy that makes their top line go. Yeah. A top line which has been one of the top maybe three or four in hockey for the last 4 or 5 years. So I understand this idea of like, well, they shouldn't have been this bad. Sure, that's fine. Except they built their team around Mark Scheifele being on the ice. Okay.
Once,
so if he takes if he takes himself off the ice, then they're not a very good team.
Once Scheifele was done, Connor and Wheeler were also very clearly done. Like, it just decimated that entire top line.
They're not deep at center. And again, like I wrote about in this Montreal piece before I started, you know, smooching their backside and trying to make nice with this team. They're the beneficiary of insane luck this postseason. Yeah. Okay, the Tavares thing, you know, there was a phantom limb aspect of you know, Tavares getting removed from the Leafs lineup, but they didn't feel the pain for 3 games. Right. But then they really felt it when they needed him in the final couple of games, especially in that overtime loss. And then they wind up playing a team where Scheifele takes himself out in the first game. So two consecutive series against two different teams that all of a sudden no longer had an advantage in the lineup, in the part of the lineup where the Habs are the weakest. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Like, these teams come into these series thinking, all right, we've got something they don't have, but then all of a sudden they lose it. So again, I'm trying to find reasons to love the Habs in these playoffs and to root for them and be appreciative of them, but I also think that their fans are deluding themselves that they don't think that they were the beneficiary of not only that good luck, but also being in a division where, you know, Calgary, Vancouver, and Ottawa laid down a welcome mat to the 4 seed in that division during the regular season.
They also got lucky. The Habs also got lucky because Dubois quit hockey. He didn't even play in that series. Like he just left. But yeah, in all seriousness, like what has happened to Dubois, and what are the Jets gonna do about it?
Well, listen, I've talked to you guys before about this season being anomalous.
Yeah.
And being a weird one for a lot of players, in particular young players. And so I don't want to judge Pierre-Luc Dubois too harshly based on what's happened in a year where things were already weird and then you ended up in Winnipeg, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, who knows what's happening away from the ice. But his playoff performance is very disconcerting because you know one of the reasons they acquired him is because of what he did in the bubble.
Yep.
And what he did in the bubble is he looked like you're kind of like Ryan Kessler-esque level up in the playoffs type performer where he's just doing everything for you. And he didn't do anything for them in the postseason. So I think from that aspect, you have to be concerned. But, you know, you get him for another year, and then you can kind of just figure out what you have with him. I mean, it's good that they didn't acquire him and then all of a sudden throw a 7 or 8 year deal at the guy, which was, you know, would have been a huge mistake at this point.
Do you feel that spending all this time trying to get invested in the Montreal Canadiens, and then, by the way, undoing most of it during this interview, but do you feel that it might just be a grandiose waste of time because they're going to get laid to waste by whoever comes out of Colorado and Vegas?
No, I don't. I mean, I think they're a team. We've seen this before where quote unquote inferior teams can get locked in. And you know, it's not simply just like Carey Price and hopes and prayers. It's four lines all kind of pulling the rope in the same direction. They've got seven, I think it's 18 different guys with at least a point in the playoffs and like maybe 12 different guys with at least a goal. So it's all kind of coming together. I mean, mm-hmm. and you know, one of the things I address in the column, and it's something that some people have discussed, you know, recently amongst like the analytics community, is this idea of maybe skill is what you need for 82 regular season games, but then it's a different story in the playoffs. And if you don't have a team that has a deep collection of better than average players, then it doesn't matter how many skilled guys you have. I know that's kind of a simplistic take, maybe because we don't have Connor McDavid and Austin Matthews and maybe not Nathan MacKinnon anymore in the playoffs, but there's something to be said for Montreal looking at times really horrible in the regular season, having us all underrate them, mm-hmm. and then coming into the playoffs and being a team that's quote unquote built for it. And if that happens, I mean, I think that's an impressive thing. And I think it's something that I hope teams don't take the let's just play defense part to heart.
Right.
I hope they take the, you know, we need to really maybe address our supporting cast as much as we address our star system.
Okay, one final thing before we let you go. The Habs are going to find out who they play possibly tonight if Vegas can take care of Colorado in an elimination game. We're all hoping for a game 7 here because this series has been so good. We just finished speaking with Merrick, and Merrick had this anecdote where he said someone from the Vegas organization texted him after they went down 2-0 to Colorado and said, okay, we got this. And I remember thinking, I'm like, that's a crazy thing to think. But they must have seen something in that series. Maybe Jared Bednar saw it too, because he was the one that kind of railed on his own guys after they lost one game in the playoffs. Are you surprised that this series has gone this way? Or maybe did you see something that kind of unfolded in those first couple of games where you're like, oh yeah, Vegas is more into this than I thought they were?
First of all, it's refreshing to hear that Merrick gave you an anecdote from after 1950. That's kind of refreshing. Good to hear. Yeah. He's really upped his game.
He got it on his rotary phone. It was good.
Yeah. You know, I love the guy. I miss the guy. So
I remember something Tim Horton said.
Yeah.
You know, funny, the 1956 Sarnia Sting had. So, I don't think
there was a 1956 Sarnia Sting.
No, that was great. That was very
well.
American.
Who knows? I'm an American.
Okay, so go.
The last two periods of game two inform the rest of the series, and I think that whoever was on Vegas that texted him that knew what they saw, which was that the Vegas quickly realized how to exert their will on the series,
yeah.
And they quickly realized how to start D'ing up the MacKinnon line, and you know what. I think the takeaway for Colorado from this series, if they lose, and I do think they're going to lose, I think they're going to close it out tonight, is you played a team that has two lines going really well that can do things on both ends of the ice. You played a team that has two defensive pairings that both can handle the other team's top line. Mm. And until you match that, until you mimic that, you may not be a championship team, because the Lightning could do it last year,
yeah.
And Vegas can certainly do it this year. But as currently constituted, I don't think that Colorado can quite do it yet. And I'm not saying that's an indictment of Nazem Kadri as a second line center, and I'm not saying it's an indictment of whatever the pairing of defensemen is behind Cale Makar. But, you know, you've got to find the solution either internally or externally. And the other thing about it too, boys, about Colorado, what I wrote their sort of like post-mortem in case they lose tonight, the window's closed on this group. They've got to sign Landeskog, they got to sign Grubauer, and they got to sign Makar. who might be looking at Shabbat money at a minimum. And so the salad days of, oh, we are this cap-friendly group that is meticulously constructed and can fit everybody underneath the cap, like, unless they're pulling some Kucherov magic next year, like, they're going to have to really make some decisions with this lineup because they need to land three big contracts with this team.
Yeah, it looks like they're going to lose Brandon Saad, who's the pending UFA. They've only got one more year of Kadri, too. You wonder if they commit to him, or maybe, I don't know if they can afford to lose him down the middle, but, you know, they probably a decision to make there.
Hey, but yeah, so, I mean, that the expansion draft looms large, too, because, you know, you could end up losing Nikushkin, potentially, Compher, potentially. You could throw Kadri out there if you wanted to lose him, because he's only got 1 year left before he goes to UFA. And then, you know, the defenseman's the real conundrum, because you have to you have to protect Taves, Girard, and Makar.
Yep.
And that's in the hopes that Eric Johnson waves his no move. So they've got a real pickle of an offseason coming up, which is maybe why they you know, went so aggressive in trying to win it this year.
Well, they've got a pickle tonight because they need to try and stave off elimination in Vegas in front of a sold-out crowd and the Golden Knights, who are playing very, very well right now. Greg, with that, we'll let you go. Enjoy the game tonight. Thank you very much for doing this, and we will talk again next week.
Thanks.